Welcome to our online course, Lower Extremity Assessment. My name is Beverly Tomasian, and I'll be your instructor today. We'll be taking a look at the assessment of the lower extremities and focus on prevention of complications. The objectives are as follows. We'll look at risk factors for lower extremity complications and amputations. We'll spend time looking at prevention strategies. We'll take a look at the steps involved in a complete lower extremity assessment, and finally, we'll conclude with diagnostic tools that help us not only assess sensation, but blood flow. During this course, if you see any words underlined in the PowerPoint slide, all you need to do is click on those, and they will provide you with additional information on that particular topic. As a diabetes educator for over 20 years, I've experienced many heart-wrenching situations with patients who've lost limbs or have had extensive ulcerations on their feet that require long bed rest, antibiotic therapy, and all kinds of special care. As educators, we can help patients prevent these complications from happening. And most of what we'll talk about is simple prevention steps, but these simple steps can save limbs. So let's get started. Why do patients get lower extremity complications? Well, it's complicated. It's a combination of vascular, nerve damage, and musculoskeletal dysfunction. And all of these come into play when patients have had long-standing diabetes and vascular disease, hypertension, and they smoke. These are all risk factors that increase their chance of this combination coming together. And we definitely know that after lower extremity amputation, quality of life drops dramatically, and there's much higher risk of mortality and subsequent amputation. The good news is lower extremity amputations have been dropping over the past 10 years, but we do know that 60% of amputations occur in 7% of the population, and we know that in particular, the risk is higher in men, elderly, minorities, and those with chronic kidney disease, in addition to diabetes. 20% of hospitalizations for the elderly are due to complications of the lower extremity. So we know a lot of our older clients with diabetes, when they're hospitalized, we've seen it. It's due to those vascular complications in their lower extremities. Amputations cost $40,000, and that's not to mention the impact on quality of life and the shortened lifespan. We definitely know that the survival rate drops dramatically after a lower extremity amputation. If we look at the relationship between diabetes and lower extremity ulcerations, you can see that up to 15% of people with diabetes do get ulcers during their lifetime. That means 85% of people don't, which is good news. But how can we decrease that 15% to help prevent ulcerations, which in many times lead to mortality and amputation? As diabetes educators, one thing we can do is identify who's at risk for foot ulcers and amputations. And on this page, I have a list of the risk factors that have been well researched that increase people with diabetes chance of having an amputation. So you can see here previous amputation, neuropathy, foot deformity, vascular disease. They can't see that well. So if you can't see, you have retinopathy. We know that the different opathies tend to come together. So retinopathy and neuropathy, plus just to cut their toenails may be dangerous. They can't see them and they might be cutting their flesh. They might need assistance but not be willing to ask for it. Other risk factors. Patients on dialysis or that have diabetic nephropathy, we know that they're at higher risk for amputation, poor glycemic control, and of course, smoking cigarettes. The pathway to amputation is outlined in this slide. First, there's minor trauma, a cut, stepping on a tack, cutting a toenail too short. Then you add this on to faulty healing. And this is common with people with diabetes because of hyperglycemia feeding bacteria. And that hyperglycemia can impair circulation and impairs white blood cell function. So the bacteria aren't fought off as effectively. These two factors then lead to the ulceration. So if we had the minor trauma, faulty healing, plus ulceration, This actually predicts 72% of amputations. People with diabetes can lose protective sensation. That means their nerves have died. They don't feel pain, pressure, heat, cold. They've lost that ability to sense. So they don't feel these things, a needle in the foot, a pebble in a shoe. They stepped on a nail and they only know by when they took off their sock, their foot started to bleed. Maybe they cut their toenails too close and their shoes were too tight and rubbing and that caused an ulceration. And there's a million other things our patients don't notice. That's why it's so important we assess their feet, we identify if they have loss of protective sensation, and then we implement protective measures. Common causes of ulcers are really related to neuropathy and peripheral vascular disease. The autonomic neuropathy can cause blood pooling, swelling, foot edema, ankle edema, leg edema, and anytime the foot or extremity is edematous, it's more difficult to wear shoes and wear them safely. And then we have some motor neuropathy. The musculature changes. There's deformity. The Achilles tendon shortens. A patient gets more of a claw foot. We'll look at this later. The joints become stiff. So now this results in increased plantar pressure and trauma. These combination of factors increase the risk of ulceration. Here is a condition known as clawfoot or pes cavus. This is a common motor and nerve deformity associated with diabetes. Here we see we have a shortened Achilles tendon, a high arch, and hyperextension of the toes. And this deformity of the foot leads to increased pressure on top of the toes, so from rubbing on shoes, and it also increases the pressure on the pad and heel of the foot. So this abnormal shape causes abnormal pressures to be put on the foot when patients walk. And many times in these situations, patients don't feel where their foot lands in space because of the neuropathy, so they even increase the injury by putting their foot down on the ground in awkward positions. And you can see even in this picture, this patient has an abundance of calluses where the extensive pressure has been incurred from the shape of her foot. One lecture I went to at the American Diabetes Association, they were speaking about what leads to ulcers, and this speaker said 80% of ulcers, the single precipitating event was too tight of a shoe. So this is why I love to have my patients take off their shoes and their sock and I look at their foot that moment. And I want to see, is there indentation from the shoe? Are there red marks? Are there blisters? Are there callus buildup? Because that too tight of a shoe can cause pressure, it can cause callus buildup, and it can really lead, decrease the circulation, etc. So we want to make sure our patients have well-fitting shoes, and we'll talk about Medicare provision for shoes later in this lecture. There's three classic types of ulcers: neuropathic, so nerve disease and ulcerations go together; ischemic, just not good circulation to the wound, so it's really hard to heal. And then we have the combination, neuroischemic, and as you can imagine, that's the worst. So the person has neuropathy plus poor circulation. These ulcerations, you've seen them, they look dry, they don't look like they're healing, you have to be non-weight bearing, and it takes forever to get those to heal and close up. Here's a picture of a neuropathic diabetes foot ulcer. Let's just take a look at this foot in more detail. Right here on the side of her toe is a huge callus. And when I see this callus, I see rubbing. The shoe was too tight. It was rubbing against her skin. The skin developed a callus formation from all of that friction over time. And then a lot of patients don't worry about calluses too much, but they really should, because a callus is hard skin buildup, and that hard skin can start damaging the soft skin underneath, and that can lead to ulcerations. So this is a big problem, and let's move on to this ulceration. So again, this patient probably has lack of sensation in her feet. She has neuropathy, and she had maybe a minor trauma. Maybe she was walking irregularly or putting pressure on her foot in ways that weren't usual because of her neuropathy. Plus, she probably has poor circulation. So the neuropathy plus the poor circulation plus trauma or pressure led to this ulceration. And since this person is not undergoing bed rest or hasn't given attention to this wound, it kept growing and tunneling, and is probably, you know, very close to involving the bone if it hasn't already. If you look at this patient's skin, you can also see it looks like there's fungus developing here. So people with diabetes, as you know, are at very high risk for fungal infections. And fungal infections can lead to severe foot infections. And so we really need to be attentive to that when we look at patients' feet. And especially in between the toes, patients are at very high risk for dead skin buildup, fissures, maceration. Always talking to patients about cleaning very well in between your toes. And just looking at her toenails here, his or her toenails, you can see they're long and they're brown. So I'm assuming that this patient has trouble cutting her toenails. They're probably thick and fungusy, so they're difficult to get through. And so this person is probably really struggling with self-care. And they may not even be able to look at their bottom of their foot to see what's happening. And maybe they don't even feel that their foot is being damaged. So this, you can see, increases, this whole picture puts patients at increased risk for these types of ulcerations. And as you know, this person is at increased risk for future amputation. Once patients get neuropathic ulcers, they take a long time to heal. And one of the most important aspects of healing is non-weight bearing. For patients to be in bed for extended periods of time with their foot elevated is very difficult. So many specialists are now recommending offloading by casting. So here's an example of a cast where the patient can still walk on this casted foot and not put pressure on the ulcer, allowing it to heal. The important thing about casting is that the person who does it is skilled at it and doesn't put any pressure in other parts of the foot, causing further problems. But a person who knows or a specialist who casts well can really help these patients improve their quality of life because they're more mobile and they can still do their activities of daily living and be less dependent on others. Here's another example of a cast. But either way, we certainly know that these neuropathic ulcers can really affect quality of life, and a lot of our patients may struggle with depression when they do have these ulcerations that take so long to heal. The American Diabetes Association also publishes a foot examination pocket chart, and I took some of those pictures from that chart and placed them on this slide. Other foot deformities we might want to take a look at are bunions. So bunions are outcropping of the bone, and the problem with a bunion is that it's going to rub against the shoe, and the skin on top of that bunion might become reddened, inflamed, or there might be an ulceration. Patients who have bunions can be treated with special shoes, so you want to make sure their shoes can accommodate this bunion and relieve the pressure, and sometimes they might require bunionectomies or surgical intervention. The other thing we might notice is these overlapping toes. So people, you know, have different feet, and as you look at more and more feet, you'll see that this is another common problem. And these overlapping toes can cause pressure on the underneath or the toes adjacent. Sometimes the nails can actually dig into the skin and cause ulcerations. We want to look at what the patient presents with and make sure that they have appropriate care, either through podiatry or orthotic shoes and specialty shoes, to help them manage this complication and prevent ulceration. A very severe form of vascular disease and neuropathy combined is called Charcot arthropathy. And Charcot is an inflammatory process where the foot becomes very inflamed and red. Usually the patient might notice that their foot is, you know, kind of red and swollen and may or may not cause pain. And if you ever see that, please bring it to the attention of the provider, because they may be entering a period of their foot collapsing. This is usually associated with high levels of blood sugar over a period of time. So these are people with well-documented hyperglycemia. Maybe they have vascular disease or smokers. They have more risk factors for foot problems. And this Charcot arthropathy is a total collapse of the foot, of the bone structure of the foot, of the tendons. The foot collapses and the bones disintegrate and you know, in a way. And so you have this rocker bottom foot. And once this happens, you can't fix it. So if we can identify it early on, many providers now are casting the foot when it's inflamed to help the foot maintain its shape and its structure. Here again is looking at that claw toe and the different pressure points associated with this particular foot deformity. In addition to neuropathy, circulation issues can certainly lead to lower extremity problems. There's peripheral artery disease, PAD, vascular disease, and smoking can complicate all of this. Let's take a look in the next slides at these different conditions in more detail. Let's talk about assessment for peripheral arterial disease. When we look at the skin, we'll notice it's pale or blue or purplish. And when we touch the skin, it's cool to touch. You're not going to see much hair, especially on the toes, because the poor circulation, if they do have wounds, they're non-healing. There's not enough good blood flow to help those wounds get better. When their foot is in a dependent position, it's red, dark red. Yet when you lift it, it turns pale. It blanches when elevated. If you try and check for pulses, they're diminished, and we'll talk about this later, but their ankle brachial index also reflects this poor circulation. In this situation, how are we going to treat this foot? Well, we're going to protect the feet, avoid constriction. We want to make sure there's plenty of blood, as much blood as possible, getting to the lower extremities. Increase walking. A lot of these patients might complain of intermittent claudication. When they walk, their calves hurt. So we know that's just a reflection of poor blood flow. If they can just take a rest and keep walking, they develop collateral vessels that help decrease this PAD and improve circulation. Whatever they can do to quit smoking is critical. So many of our patients with diabetes and vascular disease are having trouble quitting this addiction. We need to get them support, help, resources. And the phone number 1-800-NO-BUTS, B-U-T-T-S, is a great resource that's available 24 hours a day for our patients. We might utilize medications to improve blood flow, or a vascular surgeon might become involved to help revascularize that extremity and get improved blood flow. So that, again, is all going to be determined by the specialist. But as educators and as providers, we're going to assess for this PAD, let the patient know they have it, and help them take preventive measures because they're so high risk for ulcerations and complications. This is a great picture of a patient with peripheral arterial disease. You can see there is no fluid retention at all. The foot is very lean. There's no hair on it. This foot to me looks a little stiff. If we were trying to ask a patient to bend their toes, there's probably not a lot of flexibility. That's extra collagen buildup. You can see there's some dependent rubor here in the ankle area and the toes. It looks kind of red. So this patient has poor circulation to their foot at much higher risk for ulcerations. And actually, patients with PAD are at much greater risk for sudden death. So we know their whole vascularization is compromised. So we're going to keep a really close eye on this patient as far as their cardiac status, blood pressure, risk reduction, quitting smoking. Peripheral vascular disease is the other side of the coin. This is not arterial disease, it's venous disease. The blood can get down to the extremity, but it has a hard time getting back up to the heart. So as a result, the skin is warm to touch. You touch these patients' legs, it's warm, but it's edematous. The fluid is being retained in the lower extremities. The skin can look brown. It looks tan sometimes, mottled, reddish. They have sometimes brown spots on their legs. And if you look on the lower legs, they can have stasis ulcers. So these ulcers look a little bit different than the arterial ulcers. They usually are on the lower leg, sometimes near the ankle area or, the lower calf portion. The pulses are there. As compared to the arterial disease, you may have a really hard time finding pulses. So they have the pulses, but you may be hard to find because of all the fluid and the edema. So the treatment for this is a little bit different. We want the patient to elevate their feet, get the fluid back up to their heart, support hose, avoid constriction. and really making sure that their shoes are big enough to accommodate their edematous feet. Very, very important. So each of these patients is at risk for ulcerations for different reasons. So we're going to tailor our education based on our assessment. This patient has peripheral vascular disease as evidenced by the pitting edema. When pressure is applied to the skin and then the thumb is removed, you can see that the indentation remains. And it may take up to 30 seconds for that skin to resume its normal turgor. And this is probably 2 to 3 plus pitting edema. You can also see the toes are blistered. There looks to be, lots of inflammation happening here. And on this picture over here, you can see that there's discoloration of the skin. So in both these examples, there's excessive fluid, poor circulation, and on the toenails, you can definitely see evidence of fungal infection. These are pictures of feet that are at high risk for ulcerations, skin breakdown, and infection. Just looking at this little bump on the skin, perhaps that is an early abscess that's beginning to form. These patients are going to require careful surveillance and monitoring. Many of our patients with vascular disease are at risk for venous ulceration. And many times when you look at patients' legs who have vascular disease, you'll notice these darkened skin patches. And these are areas that are at higher risk for ulceration. This is another patient at high risk for infection and moving toward amputation. We're going to make sure they see a specialist and receive excellent wound care to help stop this ulceration from progressing. Another important part of our assessment is a flexibility assessment, and the hands often reflect what's happening in the feet. This is a patient that had diabetes type 1 for over 30 years, for most of the time not well controlled. And the one thing you can look for in this group of patients is something called the prayer sign. So the prayer sign is you have them put their hands together, and if they can't get contact with the palm of their hand, if their fingers can't press against each other, we know that they have glycosylation of their tendons and everything is stiffened. If it's happening in their hands, it's happening in their feet. These patients have very poor dexterity with their hands to grasp fine objects. So you might want to make sure that they can use their meter okay and drop their insulin. So this is a picture of that same patient's feet. And when I asked him to bend his toes, move his feet, he had very little ability to flex, extend, bend his toes. And it almost has a waxen look to it. I'm sure you've seen this in your patients. We know that in this situation, when they have decreased flexibility and this patient also has neuropathy, this is a high-risk foot because it can't adjust and bend to the pressure put on it. So there's going to be abnormal pressure points. And you can just imagine looking for pulses on this gentleman was pretty tough. He has some arterial disease, very difficult to palpate. Any pulses, there's not much hair on his feet or toes. Very high-risk foot. We're going to keep a close eye on this and make sure he gets follow-up on a regular basis. We talked about Charcot's foot earlier, but I'd like to spend a few more minutes on it now. Charcot foot is uncommon. You may not see it very often in your practice, but when you do, you don't forget it. The patient presents with a rocker bottom foot if they've already have Charcot disease, but sometimes we can catch it early on and help prevent this collapsing of the arch. People at risk for Charcot are those with neuropathy, autonomic neuropathy, peripheral neuropathy, diabetes for many years, that's not well controlled. There's nerve damage involved, but it's also a circulation situation. There's blocked blood vessels. So poor circulation, inflammation, damaged nerves, and the patient might, like I mentioned earlier, say my foot is inflamed or it's kind of red. Don't ignore it because that could be a sign of early Charcot developing. And as I mentioned, we can maybe cast it to help preserve the structure of the foot. So with the Charcot, there's shifting bones and then the arch collapses. So the joints collapse, the arch collapses, the bones disintegrate. And this patient now has this foot shape that puts them at high risk for skin breakdown and other complications. Here's some pictures of Charcot foot. You can see here this patient's foot is totally misshapen. They have outcropping here, and there's a little ulceration here from the pressure points, and their other foot has all kinds of problems too. If you look at these 2 feet in this picture, here's the foot, you know, what it normally looks like, and here's early inflammation associated with Charcot, and you can see the process is starting. So there's bony destruction due to loss of pain sensation and proprioception plus repetitive and mechanical trauma to the foot. That's the neurotraumatic theory, but there's also a neurovascular theory where this joint destruction secondary to autonomically stimulated hyperemia and periarticular osteopenia associated with trauma. So we're not quite sure why this happens or trying to do more research on it, but we definitely know that we can try and catch it early. And in this picture here, if we catch it during the acute phase and cast for 3 to 6 months, and then the patient wears custom footwear, there's some hope that we can maintain the structure of the foot. Looking at the stairway to amputation, we see many common threads running through this presentation. Neuropathy plus peripheral arterial disease. We have an injury or callus which leads to a wound which gets infected, which turns into cellulitis, which turns into gangrene or osteomyelitis and amputation. Given the increased risk of amputation in people with diabetes, a task force was convened to develop a comprehensive foot exam and risk assessment tool. And we'll be going over the elements in this position statement in the next few slides. I also want to point out the foot examination pocket chart published by the American Diabetes Association, which helps providers go through a comprehensive foot assessment. The first step of our assessment is to watch our patients walk. We want to see, number one, are they safe? Do they have good balance? And we also want to assess how they put their foot down. Are they putting unusual pressure on different areas of their foot because of neuropathy? We want to assess their shoes. Do they fit them correctly? So we're going to ask our patients if they're sitting down to stand up and walk so we could assess this very important part of their lower extremity health. Next, we're going to have our patients take off their shoes and socks, and we're going to look at their feet. And we know people are at higher risk if they have any of these factors: previous foot ulceration, amputation, diabetes for more than 10 years, their A1C is running high. We definitely know that if they have retinopathy or impaired vision, they're at higher risk for foot complications. And as we've mentioned, if they have any neuropathic symptoms or they're having poor circulation as evidenced by intermittent claudication. So we're gathering this data as we're talking to the patient and starting our physical exam of their feet. As part of our foot exam, we're going to look at the skin. And the health of the skin is very important because if the skin is dry or cracked, it's an invitation for bacteria to start forming. We're going to look at those high-risk areas on the bottom of the heel where lots of patients, especially if they don't wear shoes very often or they live in dry climates, will have dry, cracked skin. And we're going to also talk a lot about lotion, you know, putting lotion on top and bottom of your skin to keep it moisturized. We're going to assess for hair, and we know that grass don't grow where water don't flow. So if patients don't have good circulation, they don't have hair on their extremities. Definitely take a look at the nails. Ingrown nail edges or long or sharp nails, they don't indicate that patients, you know, are lazy or don't want to take care of themselves. Oftentimes when I see that, they can't reach down to cut their toenails. So they need help. They need assistance. And those long, sharp nails can dig into other toes and cause all kinds of problems. And I've seen nails actually grow over and curve in and grow into the skin. We want to evaluate that and make sure they get a referral to podiatry as needed. We want to look for interspace maceration. So in between the toes is a high-risk area where dead skin accumulates, and it can lead to fissures and skin breakdown. We want to look carefully in between the toes, look for fungus, get a washcloth, get rid of that dead skin. If patients can't clean in between their toes themselves, we need to get them some help to do that. We're going to look for ulcerations. Is there any break in the skin that could be leading to a bigger problem? And also, as we've mentioned, cleanliness. Is a patient able to clean their foot? their feet, and if not, we need to help get them support to improve hygiene. Some other things we're going to be looking at are breaks in the skin, as we mentioned. We're going to be looking for redness, any trauma. As we've mentioned with arterial disease, do they have pallor on elevation? Does their skin just blanch and get white when we elevate it? Indication of poor circulation. Or is it bright red when their feet are in a dependent position? We're going to look for any changes in the size or shape of the foot, especially from the last visit. So keeping an ongoing chart and documenting that is very important. Calluses. As we've mentioned, a callus, patients may not be too worried about them, but we know as healthcare providers, a callus can be hiding an ulceration. A callus is like having a rock in your shoe. And the other thing about calluses is ask patients how they treat it. Lots of patients take razors. You know, they file it down. It's uncomfortable for them. We want to make sure that they know that that should be handled by a professional, because they might get to the healthy part of the skin and keep going, and that might increase the risk of infection. Do they have any fungus on their toenails, in between their toes? And we're going to take a look out for edema. All of these factors are a part of our assessment, because we know these increase the risk of complications. According to the guidelines, there's three different screening tests we can do for neuropathy. And one is a monofilament test, and it delivers 10 grams of linear pressure. And significant findings if the patient can't feel the monofilament at one or more site. We can do vibration perception threshold testing. And the vibration perception threshold more than 24 volts indicates loss of protective sensation. Also, we can use a tuning fork, and in the tuning fork, we'll notice that they don't feel the vibration of the tuning fork on their toe, and we'll be going over these tests in more detail in the following slides. Detecting loss of protective sensation is very important, so our patients know that they cannot feel trauma to the bottom of their foot. The one accepted way of doing this is monofilament testing. Now, it's standardized. We have to use a 5.07 monofilament because that delivers 10 grams of linear pressure. So that's the gold standard. It's a fishing line, but it's a very particular fishing line that we use. Now, what we do is we touch this monofilament to the plantar surface and to the top of the foot in distinct locations. Here's the four test sites: each great toe and the first, third, and fifth metatarsal head. When using the monofilament to assess for loss of protective sensation, the first thing you want to do is apply the monofilament to the patient's arm and show them how it feels. When you actually apply the monofilament to the foot, you can see here you want to apply it in these four different locations and make sure you bend the monofilament to a C shape to deliver the 10 grams of linear pressure, and then you release the pressure. In addition to the four locations on the bottom of the foot, you can also assess the top of the foot as indicated by this red dot. The monofilament procedure, according to an international consensus group, is as follows. First, you demonstrate the procedure on the patient's forearm or hand so they know what that monofilament feels like. And sometimes it can be kind of scary. They think it's going to hurt them. It doesn't hurt. It's just delivering pressure. Have the patient close their eyes. And then we're going to test four sites in random sequence. This is really important to not do it always in the same sequence. And very important, if there is a callus, avoid that area. So get as close to the spots as possible, but just go right adjacent to the callus. Or if there's an ulcer, you want to avoid that too. Now you bow the monofilament and you can say to the patient, do you feel it, yes or no? Now, the other thing that I often do is I don't tell them when I'm actually touching the patient. I just say to them, please tell me when you feel the monofilament. So you can do it either way. You randomly test at each site three times, but one of them is a sham application. So you say, do you feel it? And you don't actually put the monofilament, and you want to see if they say yes or no. Because lots of times patients just say yes, that they feel it, when they really don't. So that is a really important thing to note. On this side that is created by the Lower Extremity Amputation Prevention Program, they have 9 sites. It is not necessary to do 9 sites on people with diabetes. This was originally developed for people with leprosy. But you can test more sites, but the 4 that I discussed in the earlier slide are the 4 we want to really assess, because if they can't feel in 1 or more of those 4 locations, then we can say they have loss of protective sensation. But I wanted to point out this slide because you'll see you can order 50 free monofilaments from this organization. They will mail it to you, and these monofilaments can be reused. You just wipe them with alcohol in between uses, and they are excellent tools for assessing our patients with diabetes. Plus, this organization also will send you an assessment chart that you can use to document your findings and share with the provider. So documentation of loss of protective sensation is very important, and we want to let the provider know that we've found this to be an issue so that they can also collaborate in working with this patient to refer to a specialist or just to keep a close eye on these patients' lower extremities. Another tool to detect polyneuropathy is a tuning fork. It has to be a 128 Hz tuning fork, and you can order those online. You're going to apply it to the plantar hallux, as listed in this picture here, and you're going to initiate vibration and see if the patient feels the initiation, and then you stop vibration and see if they feel the vibration stopping. And that can help us get the information regarding their degree of sensation in their lower extremities. Here's a procedure for the tuning fork. What we want to do first is initiate vibration of the tuning fork by hitting it on the palm of our hand, and then we demonstrate to the patient how that feels on their wrist or their elbow. So we demonstrate how it feels when it's vibrating, and then we stop the vibration so they can see what it feels like when it stops vibrating. And again, we're going to ask the patient to close their eyes. So we're going to then initiate the test by hitting the tuning fork on the palm of our hand and then placing the tuning fork perpendicularly with constant pressure to the dorsum of the first great toe, just proximal to the nail bed. And then we're going to put our finger underneath their toe to verify that the tuning fork is vibrating. So that's the first phase of the test. What is recommended before initiating the tuning fork procedure is to start with a sham test. So what you're going to do first when the patient closes their eyes is just apply the tuning fork without any vibration and ask the patient, is the tuning fork vibrating? You want to make sure they can differentiate between pressure and vibration, so they should say no. And then you go ahead and initiate the test, hitting the tuning fork on the palm of your hand and then putting it on their great toe. And then you'll ask them, is the tuning fork vibrating, yes or no? And then you'll ask them to tell you when the vibration stops. And then you actually stop the vibration of the tuning fork. So you want to make sure, can they A, feel the tuning fork vibrating, and B, do they know when it stops? You conduct this twice on each great toe. When you apply the tuning fork, you ask the patient to identify the beginning of vibration by asking, is it vibrating? And then you want to ask the patient to identify cessation by dampening the tuning fork. And then you ask the patient, tell me when the vibrating stops. You do this twice on each side of the body on the big toe. And the number of correct responses is up to 8. So you do it 2 times, vibration on, vibration off, vibration on, vibration off on each toe. So total correct answers for each toe is 4. So if they get all 8, they can feel all 8 vibration initiation and vibration cessation. That's a perfect score. If they get 5 incorrect responses, so if they only get 3 right, that equals peripheral neuropathy. So as diabetes educators, we may not be diagnosing peripheral neuropathy, but we can certainly inform the patient and their provider that they were not able to feel most of the tuning fork initiation or cessation using this procedure. In addition to a neurological assessment, we also need to do a vascular exam of the foot. The first thing we're going to talk about is palpation of pulses, and of course, a significant finding is lack of pulses. Another test that might be done in your office, or maybe you read the report, is the ankle brachial index, or ABI. And a significant finding is an ABI of less than 0.9. This indicates peripheral arterial disease. Let's talk about both of these in more detail. As part of our vascular status assessment, we're going to be assessing temperature and appearance of the lower extremities, but we're also going to be identifying two pulses, the posterior tibial pulse and the dorsalis pedis pulse. These pulses come from the posterior tibial artery and the dorsalis pedis artery. So let's take a look at where we'll find those on our patients, and we can assess the presence or absence of pulses. To assess the dorsalis pedis pulse, you can have the patient extend their great toe, and then you'll see the extensor tendon pop up. And just to the interior of that is the dorsalis pedis artery. And there's a line here on this slide showing where you would actually find that. The most important thing when you check a pulse is don't apply so much pressure that you obliterate the pulse. You have to gently touch the top of the skin and just sit calmly for a few seconds to see if that pulse is felt. So don't press too hard, just gently press. Of course, if there's edema, you are going to have to press a little bit harder to see if you can find that pulse. But this is where it's located. And when I first started checking for pulses, I just checked my family's feet, and they loved it. So it's a great opportunity to say to your family members and friends, hey, can I check your dorsalis pedis pulse? And it's really a fun activity. The other thing I want to just point out on this patient's foot is he's got lots of hair in his toe. So you can see that he's got good circulation. Just from looking at the hair, we know we're going to probably be able to find his pulses quite easily. Here's another view taking their dorsalis pedis pulse. You can see this provider has three fingers on. He's pressing firmly but not obliterating the pulse, and he's able to detect it right in that same area where we showed in the previous picture. And again, this patient, indicated by the hair in his leg, has great circulation. The posterior tibial pulse is a little more difficult to palpate. It's right behind the medial malleolus, or the ankle, and the most important part of detecting this pulse is the positioning of your hand. So let's take a look at how to position your hand in the next slide. This picture reflects the best hand position to determine the posterior tibial pulse. You put your thumb on the outside part of the ankle, and then in the inner part of the ankle, you put your fingers to determine the pulse. You have to apply gentle pressure and really get behind that ankle bone to feel the pulse. Just give yourself some time, you know, quietly letting your finger sit on top of the skin. And then after a few seconds, the pulse should become more apparent. But if the patient has arterial disease, you may not be able to find this pulse. Another test that can be performed is the ankle brachial index. And you may or may not do this in your office setting, but you may get the report. So I'd like to go over what this means and explain this procedure a little bit. The ABI looks at the relationship between the blood pressure in the arm versus the blood pressure in the lower extremity. So it's a relationship. And what they want to find out is the blood pressure in the lower extremity the same as or less than the brachial artery systolic pressure. So they should be equal. The pressure in your arm and leg should be equal, but if they're not, that might indicate lack of circulation. So the ankle brachial index is 95% sensitive and specific for peripheral arterial disease. It really does establish the diagnosis, and it also identifies a population at high risk of ischemic events. Let's take a closer look at how the ankle brachial index is determined. To do this test, we need a Doppler ultrasound, and the Doppler ultrasound is going to identify the arterial blood flow, and the blood pressure is recorded in the brachial artery of the arm. Also, we're going to look at the sound of the arterial blood flow in the ankle, again using a Doppler. The pressure is recorded in the arteries of the ankle after each arterial flow is located. So we're going to record the brachial artery pressure and also the pressure of the ankle artery to determine the relationship between the arm pressure and the ankle pressure. What we're doing with the ankle brachial index is measuring the highest systolic reading in both arms. So we're going to evaluate both arms, get the highest systolic reading, and we're going to also get the highest systolic reading in both legs. Then we calculate the ratio of each ankle to the arm pressure, and I'll show you the formula in a second here, and we divide each ankle by highest brachial pressure. And normally it should be greater than 0.9. 0.9 means the pressure in the lower extremities is the same as the pressure in the upper extremities. So that's what we're looking for. If it's less than that, we can see that there might be some arterial disease. Here's an example using the ABI. I just want to go over some of these abbreviations first. The DP stands for dorsalis pedis pulse, and the PT stands for posterior tibial. And these are both systolic blood pressures. So when we do this formula, we take the highest systolic blood pressure from the lower extremity for each side, and then we take the highest brachial systolic blood pressure. So our denominator is 160 in both of these examples. That was the highest brachial systolic blood pressure. But let's look here at the right side. The highest blood pressure here was the dorsalis pedis at 80. So we take 80 over 160. So the 80 systolic blood pressure of the ankle over 160, which is the brachial systolic blood pressure. And you can see we come up with an ABI of 0.5. So we know that's low, that the pressure in the lower extremity is half what it is in the upper extremities. So that indicates poor circulation. Let's take a look at the left. The highest systolic blood pressure on the left was the posterior tibial at 120. So we put that first, 120 over the denominator, the brachial systolic blood pressure of 160. And this equals 0.75. So a normal ABI would be exactly the same pressure or close to it, 0.99 in the upper part of the body versus a lower part. So anything less than that is suspicious. That why is the circulation not as good in the lower extremity as it is in the upper extremity? So let's talk about normal ranges more in the next slide. So as we've mentioned, the ABI of 1 to 1.29 is normal. Once we get to 0.91 to 0.99, borderline, and then you could see here at this point, it's mild to moderate disease. And as we go down the scale, it even gets worse. So this is what the ankle brachial index means when we're looking at reports or maybe you're involved with actually doing this assessment. These are what the numbers mean. In people with diabetes, the ankle brachial index can come back as a false negative. And the reason is that people with diabetes have poorly compressible vessels. So what I'm trying to say is in their lower extremity, the vessels may be very stiff and might give a systolic blood pressure that matches the brachial blood pressure. So it looks like there's good circulation, but in fact, it's just elevated because the blood vessels are so stiff. So sometimes if a patient appears and it looks like they have vessel disease, their lower extremities are pale, they don't have much hair, they have dependent rubor, but their ABI comes back normal, we're suspicious. And we're going to have to do further diagnostic testing to truly evaluate the health of their lower extremity circulation. We also want to do biomechanical foot assessment. As I mentioned in an earlier slide, some of our patients from ongoing glycosylation may have decreased mobility and flexion of their feet. So we want to have them bend their toes and their ankles and see the degree of mobility that they have. We want to watch them ambulate. We want to look at their shoes and inspect for any deformity. We're going to, in particular, look for corns, calluses, bunions, and any metatarsal heads that are prominent, hammer toes and claw toes. We also want to make sure our patients can see and reach their feet to provide the care they need. And if not, we want to provide them with resources. And we want to look, as I've mentioned earlier, for vision, gait, imbalance, and any need for assistive devices to help them maintain their skin integrity and prevent complications. Certainly, we realize that we cannot give maximum resources to everyone, so we really want to stratify patients at highest risk. The first thing we want to say is that we want to screen everyone. So anyone newly diagnosed with diabetes needs an intensive screening of their degree of vessel disease and nerve disease and risk for problems in the future. We want to make sure that all patients receive education to prevent complications due to minor trauma, injury, and report little things early on. Monitoring the condition is going to vary with degree of pathology. And then the next slide, we'll look at risk stratification. Who are our patients at highest risk at developing complications of a lower extremity? We're going to classify our patient's risk based on the following definitions. Category 0 means the patient has no loss of protective sensation or no peripheral arterial disease. In this situation, since the patient is low risk, we're going to focus on prevention and education, talking about proper shoes, not going barefoot, applying lotion, inspecting their feet every day, and we're going to reassess their feet once a year. However, if they move into Category 1, where they do have loss of protective sensation or some degree of deformity, we need to take more action, and that would be referral to a specialist for special footwear, and certainly considering prophylactic surgery if the deformity cannot be safely accommodated by the shoe. So that's the other thing we're going to consider. And we're, of course, always going to provide education. We're going to reassess this patient more frequently, every 3 to 6 months. Now, if they're Category 2, they have peripheral arterial disease plus loss of protective sensation. They also are going to need prescriptive footwear and a vascular consultation. We're going to need to follow up with them more frequently because now they have a combination of neuropathy and vascular disease and are very high risk for lower extremity complications. If they're at the highest category, Category 3, these are patients who already have a history of amputation or ulcerations. Again, we're going to provide education, prevention care, and perhaps a vascular consultation as needed. This patient will be seen much more frequently, every 1 to 2 months, to evaluate their lower extremity status. Based on our lower extremity assessment, if the patient is at high risk, we need to take more action. We need to evaluate more frequently and refer to specialists. If they have neuropathy, we're going to examine their extremities each visit. And truly, multidisciplinary care is very important. We've mentioned a few of these specialists, but not all of them. And all of these specialists can help the person with lower extremity problems or those at risk for future problems. So I think this is really good to keep in mind as we're evaluating patients' feet, that we have a whole team available that can help support prevention of complications of the lower extremity. Fungus of the foot, or onchomycosis, is a common problem with our patients with diabetes. It's a chronic infection, and it represents about 50% of nail problems. Interestingly enough, we treat fungus on the skin, but we're reluctant to treat it in the nails. And one of the reasons is because the medication for fungus can be so hard on the liver. So patients are reluctant to take it. Providers are reluctant to utilize it. But it does work well. Those antifungal medications can really help get rid of these funguses that are so difficult to treat. The average duration of fungus is more than 10 years, and rarely does it resolve spontaneously. And the problem is, if they have fungus on one toenail, it can spread to other nails, skin, and other people. And it can be a source of more serious infections. So patients can consider topical medications, they don't work as well, oral medications, but there's some new research that's been emerging on Vicks Vapor Rub. And Vicks Vapor Rub does tend to have some antifungal properties, and patients who apply it twice a day over many months tend to have improvement of their fungus. So that's one thing I am mentioning to patients as an additional tool to help treatment. One of the most important things we do with our patients is provide education on prevention of problems. These are just some of the key points: proper footwear, a daily foot inspection, looking in between those toes, soles of foot, and so important, prompt reporting of any foot lesions, discolorations, or swelling, and getting appropriate care early on to help prevent an ulceration or serious complication. We offer a variety of clinical books and resources on our website. We also offer the foot examination pocket chart. To get started, just click on this link. I'd like to share with you some excellent resources for lower extremity assessment and prevention. The LEAP program, which stands for Lower Extremity Amputation Prevention Program, was initially started to help people with leprosy, but it also has expanded to reach out to people with diabetes and neuropathy. They offer a terrific patient education booklet that you can download and print out and make free for your patients. They have a comprehensive online course for patients who have neuropathy that walks you through assessment of the neuropathic foot and helps you evaluate protocols. Click on these links for more information. In addition, the Lower Extremity Amputation Prevention Program has an excellent 5-minute video designed for healthcare professionals to look at the basic elements of a foot assessment. After you click on this link, make sure you look under LEAP Training on the right-hand column to see the video. You can also order free monofilaments. They come 10 to a package from the LEAP program. And this link will provide you with more monofilament instructions. Thank you for joining our web clinic. You have up to 1 year to complete this program from time of purchase. To complete the program and receive your certificate, all you need to do is take the post-test and complete the program survey. Now your certificate is ready to print out, and you can reprint it out anytime you like by logging in and going to the transcript page. We invite you to join us on our Facebook page for special events and coupons. Keep in touch. We appreciate you attending this program and all the work you do to improve diabetes care. This is Beverly Tomasian, signing off.